Blog Talk Radio.
I was toting my pack along the dusty Winnemucca Road, when along came a semi with a high-end canvas-covered load. If you're going to Winnemucca, Mac, with me you can ride. And so I climbed into the cab and then I settled down inside. He asked me if I'd seen a road with so much dust and sand, and I said, listen, I've traveled every road in this here land. I've been everywhere, man. I've been everywhere, man. Across the deserts bare, man. I breathe the mountain air, man. I travel, I've had my share, man. I've been everywhere. I've been to Reno, Chicago, Fargo, Minnesota, Buffalo, Toronto, Winslow, Sarasota, Wichita, Tulsa, Ottawa, Oklahoma, Tampa, Panama, Mattawa, La Paloma, Bangor, Baltimore, Salvador, Amarillo, Tocopilla, Barranquilla, and Padilla. I'm a killer. I've been everywhere, man. I've been everywhere, man. Across the desert, bare, man. I breathe the mountain air, man. Travel, I've had my share, man. I've been everywhere. I've been to Boston, Charleston, Dayton, Louisiana, Washington, Houston.
It's time for the next edition of the Riveting Jumble Justice Radio Show, broadcast worldwide on Blog Talk Radio. Turn up your speakers and listen closely, since you may be asked questions later. Keep your phone handy, since we encourage you to call in your comments to the host and guests on today's show. The listener call-in number is 347-996-5983. Once again, the number is 347-996-5983. You will also find the number on the top of the homepage for the Jumble Justice Radio Show. I'm Audrey, your technical and spiritual advisor for the radio broadcast. And now, without further delay, allow me to introduce your eminently qualified and inspiring host for Jumble Justice, Professor Keith Haley.
Thank you so much, Audrey. How could we do it without you? And of course, the answer is we couldn't. Thank you very much for getting us on the show one more time. This is our 3,694,000,000,000,000 show, right? No, maybe not. Not that many, but it just seems like that. So welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to the Blog Talk Radio Network and the Jumble Justice Radio Show. And let me say first off that I hope everybody out there survived the storms up here in the northwest area. We had some things around the area where I live. We hope people up in the Toledo area and all that, Harrisburg and Fremont, all that survived. But that was frightening, and the tornado scared me a little bit because I thought it was following me, because it hit El Reno, Oklahoma yesterday, and I used to work in El Reno and live in Oklahoma City. And then I think it also stopped down in Dallas. And then when I saw the clouds outside my home in Tiffin, Ohio, I began to wonder something's going on here. But what a devastating time. And of course, none of that can compare at all with what happened in Joplin, Missouri. And our prayers go out to those people, and assistance in any way we can is being provided, I hope, by everyone who has some way to help. But 75% of that city is destroyed. Can you believe that? I think you get another 2 or 3 weeks of this type of storm warning, I think I'm ready to buy one of those storm cellars. Oklahoma, I forget what they call it. It's a little hole in the ground with a lid. And I used to sort of giggle at that. But then again, when I saw tornadoes in Oklahoma, I didn't giggle quite as much. But terrible thing. Anyway, enough about the weather. We hope we've seen the worst of it already. I'm your host, Keith Haley. Thank you again, Johnny Cash, for taking us on that little ride across the country to 90 cities and states. Speaking of the weather, just one more time, I promise. I guess they had some trucks blow off the road on I-75, at least one, I heard reported, and then others said there were some others too. So, my gosh, how powerful that wind can get. Emily and Mike, thank you very much. Mike, you did a great job tonight hooking us up with our speaker, and we're going to do a little, might be a little tricky. We're using totally Macintosh Apple equipment from now on. And where the link up sometimes a little bit difficult, but overall it's far worth it on the Mac. Let me be biased about that. But anyway, purpose of our show is to discuss news issues and events and developments in the always difficult and sometimes humorous practice of criminal justice. There are some developments. It's Patriot Act business is going on in Congress right now, and I'm not going to comment on that tonight until I've had a chance to study up on it and see what one of the houses did today under a timeline. And I guess they're sending something to the president relative to that now in terms of preserving three parts of the current Patriot Act that would expire, I think, by midnight tonight. They're not going to send it to him. They're going to let him use AutoPen. I'm surprised that the news people didn't know what AutoPen was. But anyway, our show is dedicated to those criminal justice professionals who've worked themselves to death, and especially in times like this, they work very hard when there's emergency type of conditions. We try to look inside criminal justice practice and take a close-up look at its professional. You're on the Blog Talk Radio Network, and just remember, you can have a show, too. If you look on there and go to blogtalkradio.com, you'll shoot shows of every idea in the world, every interest group, any person. You can all have a show if you want to do that. You sign up, and within minutes, you can literally schedule a show. You get, I forget how many free hours a week. You only have to pay if you're between 7 and 11 in the evenings. They're considering that prime time now. But other than that, it's all free. You could have a 11 o'clock show and go all night, I guess. I don't know how long they'll let you go. I read, you know that. You do a little moonlighting with with Blog Talk Radio. You don't know. I didn't think you did. But anyway, I don't know how long they'll let you have a show. Why would you want a show longer than an hour, right? but some do. I did hear something today about a very interesting website called DAR.FM. And this is a site that will track 1,800 radio stations in the United States and their music, their news, their talk shows, and all kinds of things. And you go to those things, and you just log in, and you pick the shows that you want to record, and it records them for you. Then you can hear it anytime you want to. And they're all over the United States. My New York Times buddy sent me that from the tech group, and but it's called DAR.FM. Excuse me, did I say com? DAR.FM. And there's a lot of new things breaking out in the radio business via the internet. So stay tuned. There'll be more, I'm sure. And Blog Talk Radio, of course, was one of the biggest innovations ever done. Tonight we're going to do something really interesting. We're going to listen to a guy that's the expert, I believe he is, Mr. Bender, on Al-Qaeda. And Al-Qaeda is a very complicated subject from very many angles. One is, what do we do with people that we capture? I mean, who are they? Are they terrorists? Are they criminals? Are they soldiers? Are they whatever? And we have this controversy now about, you know, what to do with the so-called terrorists when we pick them up. Do we try a military court, civilian court? But this guy's really thought about it and looked at it. And he's not pleased with anybody's definition, I don't believe. And we'll listen to him talk about that tonight, and I think you'll enjoy that. You can, of course, listen on your computer or your cell phone or whatever. You can call in during the news segment of the show, which won't last very long tonight. It's at 347-996-5983, 347-996-5983. Audrey has a Bond joke for tonight. Audrey, are you ready? You're joining us for the first time. Just recall that Audrey is a blonde. She grew up in London, England. She is the world's collector of blonde jokes. She has trunks full of them. Am I right, Audrey? I am. And she has one for us tonight. Go ahead, Audrey.
Professor Haley, I hope our blonde joke tonight is not too grimacing, but I checked it out with Emily and she thought it was okay. Here goes. A blonde suspects that her boyfriend is cheating on her, so she goes out and buys a gun. She goes to his apartment that same day, with a gun in hand. Sure enough, when she opens the door, she finds her boyfriend in the arms of a redhead. She points the gun at her boyfriend and stares him down for a moment. Then, suddenly, she's overcome with grief, so she puts the gun up to the side of her head. Her boyfriend screams, "Honey, don't do it." The blonde yells back, "Shut up. You're next."
I think that fits in the category of dumb blonde, right? Right, Emily? Right, I think it does. Well, ladies and gentlemen, on a much more serious note, since we're talking about firearms, the Iowa Gun Coalition would like you to listen to this public service message. And if you have a gun and you're not authorized to have one, and you happen to be a street criminal, would you please go down and turn your firearm in to your local police department? Go ahead, Ohio Code.
Carrying concealed handguns in Ohio? It's a deadly idea. A message from the Ohio Coalition Against Gun Violence.
Well, thank you very much, Ohio Coalition, and we appreciate that fine public service announcement, and we hope there are people out there that take heed to it. Well, ladies and gentlemen, we have to have a green tip every week, and one more time, we're taking this. We used up all of Esma Floyd's tips, not yet. But Esma Floyd's little book, and it is little, called 1001 Little Ways to Save the Planet. We're going to look at her tip number 901, and some of you who are busy movie watchers should think of this. Instead of buying DVDs of your favorite films for your family, rent them from a DVD rental store, a website, or your local library. Even better, watch films on pay-per-view TV to cut down on the energy waste and the product waste. What a great idea. I'm going to do that as soon as I decide what movie to watch. But thank you very much, Esma Floyd. And those green tips, we appreciate those. And think of all the tips that we've passed out and all the energy and all that we've done to sustain the planet. I wasn't real confident the other day when I read on the internet in a news story that Al Gore, remember, he's the one that saved the planet and invented the internet. He got D in science in college, a D and a C minus. So maybe he learned more when he left college. But he's the one that goes around and explains to us what's going on in terms of global warming. Let's take a look at some of the news tonight and see what's going on. Can we start with the absurd? Let me start with the absurd. I was going to have Mike read this one for us, but I'll just start from it. There is a person in Missouri, Dixon, Missouri. In order to teach a son his teenage responsibility, they didn't let him get a lemonade stand. They let him raise some rabbits. He was selling a few hundred rabbits over 2 years' time. And it says that he's provoked a heavy hand of the federal government to the tune of, they show up. They even staked out his house. I mean, it's a very long story. But this guy was selling some rabbits. Everybody that bought him said that it was the cleanest, most cared for they'd ever seen. And then he sold them to a dealer. He began selling the meat by the pound in 2006. And his pets to neighbors. And he raised these on his little, their 3-acre lot. They were heralded by local experts for their quality and kept in pristine condition. Lo and behold, the federal agents show up, and they say he has violated a rule that says he can't sell to a pet store without a license. You have to have a license. This is one of those, you know, 3,000 felonies a day that you, 3,000 felonies that you don't even know exist. But, so the agents, they actually staked him out, and they couldn't really, one of these agents looked like he just crawled out of a exploded coal mine. Those are my words, but the description is like that. But they said that they show up, and they finally give him notice, and then they defend it. They are charging this man, this family, this boy, $90,643 fine. And, of course, you don't pay it. You're going to go to prison for that. But can you believe that the guy's raising some rabbits? He sold 300 of them. You know, how long does that take? Not very long. People are satisfied with the rabbits. They're in pristine condition. And he's trying to do something to learn how to be self-sustaining. And our federal government shows that whatever happened to discretion, okay, so he violated the law. He shouldn't do that. But do you have to fine him? Couldn't you just issue him like a warning ticket? And say, look, you really need to stop cease and desist from selling your rabbits. But I don't know. This story just sounds so federal to me. I can't believe it. You know, I'm a big fan of the study of spy chips. Well, here's a British university. It's De Montfort University. They're now giving all their students ID cards. I suspect this is already being done places where they don't even know it. And what they're voted to do, their faculty group is voted to do, is to take attendance in classes through the Wi-Fi system. In other words, you won't have to do anything. You'll just know by the spy chip that's on their student ID card when they come to class whether they're there or they're not there. And of course, I suppose with a little mapping software, you could find out if they're not there. You could probably figure out where they are if they're on campus or within a reasonable distance. But the student, the National Union of Students warned that members would balk at the prospect of being treated like inmates under surveillance. And of course, Great Britain woke up about, 20 years after they found out they were being, every move was watched. And now you actually have resistance movements in Great Britain who are actually going out and sabotaging all of the surveillance cameras. But, I think this is here. I mean, Walmart uses spy chips for inventory control, and, others use them for all kinds of different things. So this is one of those mechanisms that I don't think it's like science. You're not going to be able to turn it back, even if it walks on people's civil rights. But I thought that one was a bit much. We're going to take attendance, and who knows what else we can do with it. this is kind of an interesting one, and you've heard about this. United States Supreme Court just ruled this week, beginning of the week, that California must release tens of thousands of its prison inmates. In a 5-4 decision of the United States Supreme Court, not just the local court, the U.S. Supreme Court represents one of the largest prison release orders in United States history. The court majority said overcrowding has caused suffering and death. Like Justice Antonin Scalia, he said terrible things are going to happen. So it's going to be interesting to see what happens with this. It's one of the largest prison systems in the United States, California. In fact, it is the largest state system. And then this release is one of the largest ones that's ever been done in U.S. history. So tens of thousands of inmates out on the street that weren't there heretofore is going to make a difference in the crime rate. We finally figured out that locking up the bad guys lowers the crime rate. They're 32,000 over their stated limit capacity. They said, but look, these inmates, they're sleeping on gymnasium floors, some of them, and there may be as 54 prisoners might have to share one toilet. Oh, my heart pangs over that. That sounds like the Marine Corps, actually, or the military. Scalia says this is staggering and absurd, this decision. He says now you're going to release 46,000 happy-go-lucky felons. I mean, they're going to have a great time hitting the street and probably realizing that because the prison system's overcrowded and under court order, they might not get sent back to prison if they get caught anyway. So it's going to be interesting to see how that one actually turns out. And it won't take long to find out when they start letting them go. But they are sending some of them back to local jails. We'll finish with this one. all the to-do about, we've talked about it here on our show, but everyone else has also, all the to-do about the TSA agents groping people at the airport. Well, Texas was going to pass a law that said that TSA could not do that. And if TSA did, they were kind of like going to get rid of them. And a bunch of protesters, the Texas legislature found out that the federal government was going to withdraw flights and limit flights into the state of Texas if they did this. So they actually voted on this House Bill 1937, and they voted it down. In other words, it didn't pass. A whole bunch of people showed up to protest this, and they called them, cowards, treason, and all kinds of things. They shouted out at this thing, but these people were just tired of this treatment at the airport, and you've seen some of those pictures yourself. And again, when are we going to get smart about searching people at the airport? There is such a thing that can be done. I think our fine ally Israel could teach us something about that. But anyway, it's interesting that went on, and we'll have to see what happens. I just saw the Supreme Court ruled on something about Arizona, and I think they're going to allow Arizona to punish employers who employ illegal aliens. And that thing had been taken to the Supreme Court. Federal government says that wasn't their business. I'll have to read the details of the case, and I'll talk about it next week. But that's an interesting one, because the federal government's been kind of walking on the toes of Arizona here for about the last several years over there. Arizona's desire to do something about illegal immigration when they think that the federal government is not living up to their obligation in that regard. Okay, let's switch gears entirely and talk about about Al-Qaeda. And I think you're going to enjoy this presentation. It comes off of podcastdirectory.com, and it was one of the Book TV after the show or something like that. But anyway, it's an interesting discussion, and I think give me a second here to set this up. We're using old technology to do this. Hold on. Coming up next, Book TV presents Afterward, an hour-long program where we invite guest hosts to interview authors. This week, CNN national security analyst Peter Bergen discusses his comprehensive look at the war on terror entitled The Longest War. The best-selling author of Holy War, Inc. went inside Al-Qaeda to provide the jihadist perspective on the conflict, as well as that of American officials. Mr. Bergen talks with Council on Foreign Relations Senior Fellow, Max Booth.
Peter, first I'd like to congratulate you on another important and terrific book. This is the third one you've done on the history of Al-Qaeda and Osama bin Laden. I think it's fair to say that you have established yourself as the preeminent historian of the radical Islamist movement, and I think this book shows why, because it's concise, it's witty, it's fair, it's passionate. I think it's really the best summary of what's happened since 9/11. Let me start by asking you a very basic and yet hard to answer question, which is, what should we be calling the conflict about which you write? The subtitle says the enduring conflict, but what do we call it?
Well, Max, first of all, thank you for this comment. I'm very happy that you really well-qualified author like yourself has read the book and so we're having this discussion. What should we call it is a very interesting question. I don't think we've come up with a language. I think there's a linguistic problem about this conflict because, you know, as I say in the book, you know, President Obama had a pretty interesting question when he came into office, which was how to define the war formally called the War on Terror. I think the liberal side of the Democratic Party and a lot of Europeans would have liked him to redefine it as a global police action against terrorists, and I think that would have been naive on multiple levels for a start. Al-Qaeda has been at war with us since 1998, certainly when they blew up our embassies in Africa. They've declared war on us. They've done warlike things. For us to kind of pretend that it isn't a war, I think would be wrong. On the other hand, I think President George W. Bush, by framing it as a quasi-existential conflict, which he did 9 days after 9/11, also overestimated the problem. Al-Qaeda is a serious problem, but it's not Marxism or communism. I don't think we've had the language to explain it exactly, because it is a form of warfare, but the nearest form of warfare that, in American historical terms, is perhaps the war against the Barbary pirates in the late 18th century, which was certainly a war, but it wasn't an interstate war, and it wasn't, you know, going to destroy the Republic.
I think one of the difficulties with naming it is that with the Barbary Wars, we weren't afraid to say the Barbary Wars. With the Indian Wars, we weren't afraid to say Indian Wars, whereas since 9/11, we've essentially been afraid to say Islamist Wars because for the war on Islamism or violent Islamism, because that sounds like the war on Islam, which is, of course, the very thing we want to avoid.
Well, and what President Obama says, and has said very often, is it's a war against Al-Qaeda and its allies, and I think that frames useful to just say, you know, just as FDR didn't declare war on U-boats, he declared war on Nazism. It explains who the enemy is, and yet particularly useful because if you say Al-Qaeda and its allies, it allows you to de-ally yourself from Al-Qaeda, and therefore we're no longer at war with you. So, for instance, if elements of the Taliban ever got around to saying actually Al-Qaeda is a bad thing, Bin Laden's a bad thing, 9/11 was a bad thing, you know, that would they would be de-aligning themselves. We would no longer be at war with them. They haven't said that. I'm not holding my breath that they will. I mean, we've had this discussion before. I don't think they're rational actors. In a sort of Kissinger-like moment, they're not going to say, well, actually, most of what we thought was wrong. I don't think they're going to do that.
Well, it's very rare that you would ever see that kind of moment in a low-intensity conflict in a war against an insurgency or a terrorist, because it's very rare that they, like the Japanese on the deck of the Missouri, that they sign instruments of surrender, and instead those movements tend to peter out over the course of a generation or more.
Right. Right, and so, I mean, I think Al-Qaeda will peter out. You know, one of the best lines in early on that George W. Bush said, I presume it's written by Mike Gerson, was that Al-Qaeda would potentially, you know, be confined to the dust in the history at a certain point. So he said the unmarked grave of discarded lies.
Yeah.
The actual
great line.
The great
yeah.
line. It was a great line, and I think it's true. I mean, it is a set of lies, essentially. I mean, for a group that positions itself as defending Muslims, it's fiction for most of the positions. And it also is losing the war of ideas in the Muslim world. One of the points they're trying to make in the book is that, you know, support for suicide bombings in Iran, Al-Qaeda is, you know, tanking in most Muslim countries for the very good reason that the people have kind of looked at the phenomenon more carefully and realized the ideology that attacked Pakistan on September 11th, 2001 is the same ideology that sent suicide bombers into hotels in Jakarta, or, you know, oil facilities in Saudi Arabia, hotels in Amman, Jordan, and the list goes on and on.
Well, it's very easy to say based on the kind of evidence that you're putting out there, and indeed a number of people do say, well, then what's the big deal? I mean, these guys are losing support in the Islamic world. They're not going to topple a bunch of regimes across the Middle East. They're certainly not going to establish this caliphate across the Middle East. So why should we even care about them? Why should we devote the kind of resources and attention that we've been devoting to them since 9/11?
Yeah, well, I mean, it's not an implausible argument to make. I don't share that view, and I'm pretty sure you don't, because, you know,
I'm playing devil's advocate.
But, you know, it's, I mean, merely because we don't face an existential threat from Al-Qaeda doesn't mean that they aren't a threat of some form. Calibrating the kind of threat. I mean, if you go back to, for instance, say 2009, if Al-Qaeda and the Arabian Peninsula succeeded in blowing up Northwest Flight 253 over Detroit, killing 300 Muslim Americans on board, more people on the ground, you know, it wouldn't have been a 9/11 style event, but it would have been a fairly big deal. For a start, I think it would have dealt a crippling blow to the Obama presidency. Secondly, I think, yeah, clearly it would dealt a crippling blow to global aviation, tourism, international travel, which is the lifeblood of the global economy. And we would have recovered, but it would have been it would have been a substantial problem. So, you know, they're capable of still inflicting substantial, you know, losses, somewhat substantial losses. But they're, you know, far from existential, and they're not where they were on 9/11.
Let's talk a little bit about our post 9/11 response. You are quite critical in elements of the Bush administration policy. For example, you write, the GWAT framework, the Global War on Terrorism framework, propelled the Bush administration into its disastrous entanglement in Iraq, which had nothing to do with 9/11, but was launched under the rubric of the War on Terror. Yet at the same time, you also write, there is little doubt that some of the measures the Bush administration and Congress took after 9/11 made Americans safer. You cite, for example, the Patriot Act, the setting up of the National Counterterrorism Center, no-fly list, U.S. cooperation with foreign intelligence agencies, some other things, primarily in the security realm. So where do you come down, bottom line, on the Bush administration? Did they do more harm than good or more good than harm? Did they make America and the world safer in the end?
You know, just historians will be debating that. I mean, clearly, I think overall, the Bush administration, you know, did a lot of things that made sense. But they also did some things that I think didn't make sense. I mean, the invasion of Iraq being, you know, essentially the biggest issue.
We'll talk about that in a minute.
Okay, but, you know, I think coercive interrogation, I don't use the word torture in the book because I think it's sort of loaded. If you have, you know, any federal prosecutor or FBI agent whose life and bread and butter is effective, non-coercive interrogation, would have said that this was both unnecessary and illegal. And I share that view. Guantanamo didn't do as much good, obviously, in the war of ideas. Particularly when we were preaching the virtues of democracy and human rights in the Muslim world, but hypocritically seem to reserve the right to ignore those when it suited our purposes. And, you know, the Battle of Tora Bora, which I devote a chapter to, is, you know, I mean, you're an historian of small wars in this country, and, you know, the victory against the Taliban was one of the great unconventional victories of you know, the post-World War II time frame. But the same set of policies that allowed us to overthrow the Taliban failed completely at the Battle of Tora Bora. That would be small numbers of special forces on the ground working with the Northern Alliance, you know, failed at the Battle of Tora Bora, and Al-Qaeda and Bin Laden and Ayman al-Zawahiri, top leadership, escaped from Tora Bora. And again, historians will be debating whether there could have been another approach that would have, you know, we don't know where Bin Laden is. At that time, we had, right now we say, you know, that Bin Laden may be in the Northwest Frontier Province of Pakistan, like that. Bin Laden may be in Virginia, it's not a very peaceful. At the Battle of Tora Bora, we had his coordinates down to, you know, perhaps 1 kilometer away from where he was. And we had multiple radio intercepts of his presence.
Yeah. No, I mean, I don't dispute what you say about Tora Bora being a huge miscalculation.
Yeah.
There's no doubt that it was. I have some more reservations on, in terms of your position on Guantanamo, because I think the administration was in a very tough position where it faced either the prospect of setting up some kind of a new facility to hold terrorist detainees indefinitely, or else processing them through the criminal justice system. And obviously there were huge downsides to processing them through the criminal justice system. Where do you come down on that? I mean, do you think that everybody should go through the normal criminal courts?
Well, Guantanamo is very complex because a lot of it is, you know, the legal principles surrounding it, which eventually the Supreme Court found against quite a number of the Bush claims, for instance, that they, you know, no right to have your corpus, lawyers, and these kinds of things. And then there were the people who were put in Guantanamo, which these are two different things. And a lot of the people who were put in Guantanamo shouldn't have been there in the first place. I quote multiple FBI senior Al-Qaeda experts who said we didn't get a lot of useful information. On the other hand, you have people like Khalid Sheikh Mohammed now at Guantanamo, who was at the FBI, who's a prison. And what you do with him is, you know, you're not pretending it's easy, and of course the Obama administration has not found it easy. But as a general principle, you know, we're sitting here in Manhattan. Federal courts in Manhattan have a 100% conviction rate for terrorists. I mean,
there's also a lot of cases that were not brought because the government, especially in the Clinton administration, for example, didn't think it had enough evidence, for example, before a secret indictment was delivered against Bin Laden. It couldn't really move against him, right?
Right. That's a very good point. They didn't really know enough about Bin Laden until that secret indictment came down, probably in late 97. And in fact, that secret indictment was partly based on some of the things he said to us in the CNN interview that I produced in that stuff, in which he was inciting violence against American soldiers. Look, Max, I'm not pretending that this is easy, but I think that a lot of the early decisions, and I try and be fair to the Bush administration in the following way. The context of these decisions was in the context of the anthrax attacks after 9/11. Condoleezza Rice is quoted in the book saying, you know, after 9/11, the system was flooded with information about every possible threat. So every 7 a.m. national security meeting was just a, you know, this huge panoply of potential things that might be very bad, that might go wrong. Everything was sort of coming into the system. And that was the context in which these decisions were made. I think that many of these decisions were wrong. And I think it's not my opinion, it's either the Supreme Court's opinion or it's what the Bush administration eventually did, because if you look at the Bush administration the first term versus the second term, it's really sort of night and day.
I think they pulled back on some of the excesses and compelled to do so to some extent by Congress and the courts.
Right.
But a lot of the things that they did have stayed in effect, and in fact have been endorsed by President Obama.
Well, that's exactly what I was going to say. So it's not that there is a, you know, the continuity is between Bush term two and Obama term that we're in. There's a lot of continuity. And, I mean, you know, in particular, obviously in Afghanistan, you know, not only continuity, but essentially the Obama administration doubled down. And since we last talked about Afghanistan, you know, I think there's been a huge, very underreported shift, which is December 2014. Now, let's do the Bush term where a Republican president has said, We're going to be four more years in Afghanistan with substantial numbers of troops, and in fact, we'll be there after that. As they, you know,
well, if President McCain was saying that Senator Obama would be leading the opposition.
Well, maybe not Senator Obama, but certainly the liberal side of the Democratic Party would be doing.
No, I think it would be Senator Obama based on his past record, because I think being in the commander-in-chief seat has given him a different perspective that he didn't have as a senator and that lawmakers just don't have.
Well, maybe, but also, you know, early on Obama was, you know, he was always characterizing the Afghan war as sort of the good war and the Iraq war as the wrong war. But the fact, you know, there's no debating about the fact that the liberal side of the Democratic Party would be very opposed if this was a Republican president. Because it doesn't fit with the narrative of the Nobel Peace Prize winning president, the weak on national security Democratic Party, it's sort of, it's not just the Democratic Party, it's the press itself is just missed its father. It's a huge story. It's a much bigger story than the story of the surge of 30,000 troops, which I get into in some detail on the book, which was the subject of incredible press attention at the time.
No, I think there's no question that what Obama has done is highly significant in the case of Afghanistan, and I've gone out of my way to praise him, because I think
right.
What he's doing is really courageous in terms of breaking with the dominant wing of his own party.
Yeah, and he knows, and the American public has, of course, turned against the wall. So, you know, this is some political risk, but I think part of it is this is a psychologist. These are the kinds of, I agree with you is that, you know, if you look at the Afghan-Pakistan problem in a serious way, and you're with that problem, living with it for years, as the administration has had, you come to the same. If you go back to Paul Woodward's book, and McChrystal's asked, you know, during these meetings, with General McChrystal was asking, you know, 40,000 soldiers as his real ask up to 2013, doubling the size of the Afghan National Security Forces. In the book, I recount having the National Security Council meetings. This was greeted with horror because it was a severe case of sticker shock about how much this would cost. Well, now, we just heard in the last couple of days that the Afghan National Security Forces are going to be doubled, up to 400,000. We are going to be there, you know, we now passed December 2014 even. And so all the things that the U.S. military asked for in these meetings is actually they've been given more, which is kind of, I think, ironic given the pushback at the time.
Well, I'm not sure they have been given more. I mean, it's still only 30,000 troops, whereas General McChrystal has been asking for a surge of 40,000 as the medium option.
Yeah, but the 40, you know, there was some 7,000 from NATO. We just said there's another 1,400
Marines
going. It's
not, it's not exactly as close.
But he was up until 2013. Now it's there on the top of 2014. I just think that, the military kind of view of this and the administration's view is pretty closely aligned at this point.
Well, I think that's absolutely right. And what's also interesting is the extent to which many of the arguments about Afghanistan are very similar to the arguments that were being made about Iraq a few years ago, because when we were in the middle of the Iraq War, the critics were saying this war is unwinnable, and anyway, we don't need to win it, because the real battle, the central front, is in Afghanistan. And now that we are in Afghanistan, we're hearing, hey, the war is unwinnable, and B, that's not the real central front in the war on terrorism. It's in Pakistan, it's in Yemen, it's in Somalia,
right.
It's somewhere else. How do you respond to those criticisms?
Oh, I mean, there is a problem in Yemen, but that doesn't mean that we should sort of abandon the attack. Afghanistan, Pakistan is the central front, for want of a better term. I mean, Osama bin Laden is there, Ayman al-Zawahiri is there, al-Qaeda was founded in Pakistan in 1988, in Peshawar in the Northwest Frontier Province. I mean, this is an area that they know very well. Westerners keep coming to be trained in the tribal regions of Pakistan. And, a kind of subset of the argument you're making, is the idea that, well, because they're in Pakistan, we should be doing less in Afghanistan.
Right.
Well, I mean,
a lot of people argue we should really concentrate on Pakistan rather than Afghanistan.
We need to do both. I mean, short of an attack in Manhattan, the straight for the tribal regions of Pakistan, we can't send ground forces. If such an attack happens, I think that the politics around that would change. But we should be doing as much as we can in both places. Because we've already run this case twice before. I mean, we've already done it. We've done nothing in Afghanistan in the past. In 1989, we posed our embassy there. The George W. Bush administration didn't do enough because of their ideological opposition nation building post 9/11. And so, you know, we already know what that looks like. It would be more persuasive if we hadn't already tried to do either nothing or do it light. We've already done those approaches, and they were both found wanting. I think that we finally have the strategy right. But I think that if a year from now or 18 months from now, we're sort of still in the same place, I think a lot of people, presumably including yourself, would have to say, you know, perhaps this is not working for whatever reason. Are you talking about Afghanistan or Pakistan? I'm talking about mostly Afghanistan. What about Pakistan? Because, I mean, I do think that we are basically on the right path in Afghanistan. That doesn't mean we're necessarily going to prevail, but I think we do have a plausible strategy and the resources to carry it out. I'm not so certain that's the case in Pakistan. Do you feel like we're on the right track? If not, what should we be doing?
Well, I mean, Pakistan is very difficult, but let me just throw up, because we hear so many of the problems about Pakistan, let's throw up some things that are actually quite promising. One, you have a real independent press in Pakistan now. 10 years ago, you just had, state TV. Now you've got several, dozens of news stations, with some of those which are quite anti-American, but they're also quite anti-Taliban, and they're quite pro-democracy as a general principle. Secondly, you have the lawyers' movement, which basically got rid of Musharraf, the military dictator there. Thirdly, the pro-religious, the pro-Taliban religious parties, political parties, have been annihilated the polls in Pakistan. Pakistan does not want Taliban-style rule. The pro-Taliban religious parties only got 2% of the vote in the last election. So, there's some positives. The negative, of course, is there was a brilliant story by Charles de Gaulle in the New York Times a few days ago about the assassin of the governor of Punjab who was showered with petals by the same lawyers who got Musharraf out of power, which I think is quite disturbing, because these are educated people who are pro-democracy, yet they're reporting the guy who, assassinates one of the most important politicians in the country just on the basis of his opposition to the blasphemy law.
Right, and this is not on the wild frontier. I mean, this is in the very heart of urban Pakistan.
Right, that is worrisome. So, I mean, people have been predicting the fall of Pakistan for years. I've always been very skeptical. I've been living there since 1983, and Pakistan has gone through much worse than, they lost half their country in 1971. They've lost or drawn 3.5 wars with India. I mean, they've had a lot of existential crises.
Yeah. Pretty much every major foreign policy call they've had to make, they've made the wrong decision.
Well, except for throwing that in their lot with the United States and essentially destroying the Soviet Union in Afghanistan. And that was a good call.
Well, yeah, that was a good call, but then the fact that they were, giving most of their support to Hezmacha and the other ultra-radical jihadists, that was not such a good thing in retrospect.
That was a bad call. And, they've had lots of certain costs in aligning themselves to the United States. After all, the United States in this conflict, because, the United States scored a 20% favorable rating in Pakistan in every poll going back years. The United States is more popular. And so every government there has to perform a fairly delicate balancing act. But, I agree, it's a cliche, but the war is mostly about Pakistan. And I think that if we'd had this conversation 2 years ago, Max, we would have been surprised if the Pakistani military had gone in a serious way to fight the Pakistani Taliban and SWAT and in southern Waziristan. But that may be the feeling of what they're prepared to do. And that, in fact, might do. We're not going to get much more from that.
Are there levers that we have that we're not using? Are there things that we ought to be doing that we're not doing? I mean, it seems like we've tried everything, and at the end of the day, we have very limited leverage over Pakistan.
As the country with nuclear weapons, it will be the fifth largest country in the world in 2015. They've got a 500,000-man army. We can't just bop them around, and it was very naive to think that we could. And I think that we have a better policy with Pakistan on two levels, two very important levels. We've got, under the George W. Bush administration, we send people to Pakistan, to Secretary Powell, and they were publicly calling Pakistan to do more. That was very counterproductive. The Pakistanis think that they're doing quite a lot. They've lost more soldiers fighting the Taliban than we have, the United States and NATO combined in Afghanistan. And they say that, and it's true. And secondly, we're offering Pakistan a long-term strategic partnership. And I think that, Pakistan thinks that this is a fair-weather friend with some justification. And we need to kind of try and get past that. And our interests and their interests are more aligned today than they were several years ago. And so that's a good thing. But we shouldn't expect miracles. And if I was General Kiani, I'd be making a lot of the same decisions. He's going to be bordering on Afghanistan and India. Pakistan is, forever. We are going to leave at some point.
Well, I have to say, I'm not I'm a little disappointed, but not surprised that you haven't come up with a magic solution to the problem of Pakistan. I wish somebody would figure out how to solve it, but I've been looking for years, and I haven't found anybody
That would be good. I mean, you know, 60% of Pakistan's economy is the textile business. And, you know, the tax on French textiles are relatively low in this country, but our Pakistani textiles are relatively high. You know, that would be a substantial thing. Of course, there's, you know, certain people in North Carolina and Congress who kind of be opposed to this, but, you know, fixing some of the tariff barriers on Pakistani textiles, that's the kind of thing that you concretely do that will buy you a lot of goodwill, which I hope will happen.
I agree with you. I think that is a good thing. It's not going to solve the problem.
No,
certainly it will help to make it perhaps a little more prosperous and a little less inclined towards radicalism. Most of your book, obviously, is a history of the last 10 years. So let me get back a little bit to some of the history, which is primarily about the Bush administration and their responses to 9/11. We talked earlier about some of the good and the bad that the Bush administration did, in your view. Should President Bush be credited for the fact that there has not been a major terrorist attack on American soil since 9/11?
Sure. But you should be discredited for the fact that the 9/11 happened. I mean, this was the largest mass murder in American history, and, you know, President George W. Bush and Tommy Lee Rice and people in the administration were getting a lot of information about the possibility of a major al-Qaeda attack, and they were sort of slipped. And President Bush took the longest presidential vacation in 3 decades, the summer of 2001, despite the fact that he was getting all this information. Condoleezza Rice testified before the 9/11 Commission that the government was a battle station during the summer of 2001. It wasn't. Historical record shows that, I mean, I do something very simple in the book, which is just look at the public statements and private actions of all these people and in the Bush administration, that they in their private meetings and in their public statements, the threat didn't really register because it didn't fit with their worldview of what was a threat. I mean, they were concerned about anti-ballistic missile defense, China and Iraq, and al-Qaeda just didn't fit with their worldview. Part of it is they have been out of office for 8 years, and they haven't really processed the fact that a non-state actor like al-Qaeda could be a serious threat.
I think that's certainly a fair criticism, but as you say, the other side of the ledger is that after 9/11, they suddenly became very alarmed and did a lot
right.
of things, some of which were highly controversial, some of which maybe went overboard, but a lot of which I would argue, and it sounds like you would argue as well, were actually pretty effective in blunting the future threat of al-Qaeda.
Sure. I mean, bringing down the wall between the FBI and the CIA is long overdue. So that information gathered in an intelligence operation could, you know, be handed to law enforcement. I mean, these things were sort of no-brainers, but it took 9/11 for it to happen. I mean, there's an interesting thought experiment that I don't do in the book, but what would have happened if Al Gore was in office on 9/11? Why? Personal view is the Democratic Party would be out of business.
Yeah. Because they would be blamed for the attack?
Well, because it would have all happened under their watch. You know, I mean, it's a bipartisan failure. I think that George W. Bush, administration comes in for more criticism, I think, in my book. But, you know, both administrations did not respond to the USS Cole. Mike Sheehan, who was the ambassador for counterterrorism to the State Department, famously said, after the Cole attack, what's it going to take? Al-Qaeda attacking the Pentagon before we respond. So, you know, the lame duck Clinton administration didn't respond to the Cole, and then the new Bush administration didn't respond to the Cole, partly because it didn't happen on their watch. You know, they didn't. And, you know, Osama bin Laden certainly took some lessons from that. I mean, when they were preparing the 9/11 attack, one of the things I try and say in the book is that 9/11 was a strategic failure for al-Qaeda. Obviously, at the time, it seemed like a big success, but it was a tactical success, but not a strategic victory because it didn't achieve any of the goals of the organization. But one of the things that al-Qaeda has said post-facto many years later was, in fact, 9/11 was heavily conceived to get the United States to invade Afghanistan, lead them to death there. That's the post-facto rationalization. What they really expected was the United States would pull out of the Middle East. The Saudi regime and the Mubarak regime in Egypt would then crumble, and they would get Taliban theocracies around the Middle East. Well, none of that happened. And they didn't, and the lack of response to the Cold meant that they thought that the only kind of response that the United States would do was cruise missile attacks or perhaps bombing runs on that training camp. So they evacuated that training camp. They didn't prepare for an invasion of the country. They were surprised by that. And so Al-Qaeda, which means the base in Arabic, lost its base in Afghanistan. They never recovered anything like it. One of the things I'm, you know, when people say, well, there's only 60 members of Al-Qaeda in Afghanistan and 350 in Pakistan, yeah, sure, that's factually true, but it's also, it's sort of irrelevant. There are only 200 members of Al-Qaeda on 9/11. It's always been a small group. And so, but what they had before 9/11 was a country at their disposal, and they had thousands of thousands of people going through their training camps. And to focus only on Al-Qaeda in this context, I think is a mistake, because every Muslim terrorist group and insurgent group in the world was either headquartered or had a major operation in Afghanistan before the Taliban. So, and of course, Al-Qaeda stood at the apex of this. So if the Taliban came back in Afghanistan, it wouldn't just be Al-Qaeda, it would be a whole sort of alphabet soup of Lashkar-e-Taiba, Jihad Hamid, Moral Islamic Liberation Front, you know, the list goes on and on. It would be kind of welcome back into the fold.
Absolutely. What about the decision to invade Iraq? Obviously that was a more controversial decision than the Bush administration decision to go into Afghanistan, and you're very critical in this book about the invasion of Iraq. You even go so far as to say, by any rational standard, the country did not pose a real threat to the United States. Now, I agree with a lot of your criticisms of the way that the war was conducted. I think you're beyond the money in terms of the lack of preparation for the post-invasion phase and the way that the Bush administration took a tie off Afghanistan to focus on Iraq. I think that's all true, but I can't help thinking you're going a little bit far there when you say that by any rational standard, Iraq could not have posed a threat to the United States when this was a country we had previously fought before. It was a country that had invaded two of its neighbors, Iran and Kuwait, a country that seemed to dominate the world's supply of oil. Clearly it had been and continues to be a strategic threat to the United States. Otherwise, we wouldn't have had a no-fly zone. We wouldn't have had UN restrictions, all these other things, trying to hand in Saddam Hussein. So are you really so confident that there was no rationale at all for toppling Saddam Hussein?
But the stated rationale also turn out to be wrong. WMD was the big thing, the weapons of mass destruction. I didn't deal with that so much in the book because it's been well dealt with elsewhere, but I do get into in quite some detail about the notion that Al-Qaeda and Saddam Hussein were linked. And the reason that's important is you had to make several changes. If Saddam was going to be a threat to the United States, you had to say several things, not just one thing. You had to say the things you just said. You had to say they had WMD. But because you didn't have a ballistic missile system that could deliver these WMD in the United States, you had to say that he was linked to terrorists, including Al-Qaeda, and that he might give his WMD to Al-Qaeda. And one of the most persuasive elements at the time when I saw Secretary Powell speak to the United Nations was the idea that Saddam was training Al-Qaeda on weapons of mass destruction. Unfortunately, that turned out to be the fruit of an extraordinary rendition. A guy called Al-Labi was taken to Egypt in order to not be tortured. He gave up all sorts of false information. And that information was even before Powell made his speech, Defense Intelligence Agency and others were saying that Al-Libi was probably lying. So the chain of logic that allowed you to think that Saddam did pose a threat to the United States, and the whole chain was wrong.
Well, yeah, it turned out he didn't have WMD. It turned out he didn't have Al-Qaeda connections. But I think you're going a little bit far in the other direction by saying he didn't pose any threat at all to the United States.
Well, it depends what you mean by threat to the United States. And now I'm talking, perhaps a little appropriately about threat to the United States proper. I'm not talking about threat to American interests writ large.
This was a guy that we've had to fight before.
Right.
In fact, he did threaten American allies. He did threaten the supply of oil.
Sure.
He wasn't plotting to attack the American homeland, but he was certainly plotting to undermine vital American interests in the Middle East.
Yeah, but I think the historians will probably say that he was pretty well contained. how is he going to spread?
I think there's still an argument you can make about that because, prior to 9/11, a lot of people thought that the sanctions regime was coming, and in fact, we know that he was violating the Oil for Food program in a massive way. He was seeming to undercut a lot of the international controls and doing it actually pretty successfully.
Yeah, certainly for his own benefit and for his family. But I mean, I think that was more of sort of a classic success than a strategic threat to the United States. I mean, there's no doubt he was violating the terms of the agreement. You know, his own people suffered tremendously as a result of those sanctions, which he was, it was a move to have smart sanctions, to recall, that it would be better targeted as a regime. But if the history of sanctions the United States has put on these countries has not been one of great success.
Right. Which was the case that a lot of folks in the Bush administration made for why we had to deal with them once and for all, why we couldn't count sanctions regime to contain them.
Well, but then, the other side of that ledger is the 4,500 Americans who will not come to terms to their families, the 100,000 Iraqis, estimate who died, the pro-Iranian regime that's now been installed for the first time in that country.
I'm not sure they're pro-Iranian. I think you can have an argument about that.
Well,
so let me ask you about. Those costs. I don't want to deny the cost of the war.
Right.
I would argue about whether it's actually a pro-Iranian regime. There's nobody who can deny the 100,000 lives lost or thereabouts and the tremendous devastation, all the negative consequences that have flowed from that. Is there, however, I wonder if there. I think it's too early to judge the positive side of the ledger because in fact Iraq is just starting to emerge as a democracy, and we have to see if it'll be stable, if it'll stick on the path which it's on at the moment. But the other thing I think I have to see is, which I'd like to ask you about, is what is the impact of the rise and fall of Al-Qaeda in Iraq? Because you go into that in some length in the book.
Well, I think it's a very big deal. Al-Qaeda in Iraq, which had no foothold before Saddam, with the invasion of Iraq, at a certain point came to control a third of the country, and much of the Sunni population was actually under Al-Qaeda. This is a insurgent group that controls a lot of population and territory. And then through their own mistakes, it was almost sort of an assisted suicide because it was their own mistakes plus the Sunni awakening plus the United States taking advantage of the Sunni awakening to deal with Al-Qaeda.
I think that if you're going to be critical of President Bush or some of his blunders early on in the war, I think you have a right to be. I think you also need to give him credit for, in 2006, reversing course of the surge and making a decision to switch to the turnaround.
And I give him full credit for that. I mean, look, that was a decision that was taken. I mean, I thought at the time it was doubling down on a bad bet. The party was going to be very little about Iraq. So almost the entire foreign policy establishment, including people in the Republican Party, Senator Lugar was kind of against the surge, obviously.
Right.
Almost
everybody in the military establishment, too, I might add.
Right. And in-
well, I think that's a really good sit-down over coffee discussion of the whole terrorism, Al-Qaeda thing, and you see the disagreement in different interpretations of various segments and elements of that whole situation. Very interesting. And, of course, you can buy Mr. Bender's book, or you can go to booktv.org under the podcast section and listen to the remaining portion of it. You're a little over halfway through the presentation right at this point. Well, thank you very much for joining us tonight, and we're going to sign off, and we'll be back again next week. And let's have Vera Lynn sing that beautiful song she sang. We'll meet again.
Again, don't know where, don't know when, but I know we'll meet again some sunny day. Keep smiling through, just like you always do. Till the blue skies drive the dark clouds far away. So will you please say hello to the folks that I know. Tell them I won't be long. They'll be happy to know that as you saw me go, I was singing. We'll meet again. Don't know when, don't know when, but I know.